Hello, you are listening to Prof Talk on UBC's CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Welcome to Prof Talk. I'm your host, Farha Khan. My guest today is Dr. Rashid Soumaila, who's professor and director of the Fisheries Center in the Fisheries Economics Research Unit here at UBC. He's deeply interested in how economics, through integration with ecology and other disciplines, can be used to help ensure that environmental resources are sustainably managed for the benefit of all generations. Dr. Soumaila has authored over 120 journal articles and several book chapters and other publications, including appearances in Science, Nature, and the Journal of Environmental Economics and Management. He has given talks at the UN, the White House, the US Congress, the Canadian Parliament, the House of Lords UK, and the WTO. His work has been cited in several media outlets around the world, and he has won numerous awards in his field. It's a great pleasure to have him here live in studio in CITR. Thank you so much, Rashid, for coming in today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
I thought I was... start our conversation about you. Can you describe for us a little bit about your background and your journey to your current position as professor here at UBC?
Yeah, that is quite an interesting one because I started off my first degree at the University of Ahmadu Bello University back in Nigeria, that is in Zaria. And actually, I took a degree in what is called quantity surveying in the British system, which will be like cost engineering, essentially. But by the end of the course, I kind of felt like, okay, if I'm a building technologies quantity surveyor, I end up in the professional office, probably making lots of money, but that will be the end of me, right? So I decided I wanted to do something more public-oriented, and so that took me into economics. So after my first degree, I went off to Norway to pursue graduate studies, and then I moved into economics and built myself up. 2 years of undergraduate work in addition to my first degree, then the master's in economics and a PhD in economics. Now, when it was time to do my thesis, my research supervisor then, Flom, a very wonderful Norwegian professor, kind of managed to get me into fisheries. And since then, I haven't regretted. So my PhD thesis was on some fisheries. And I build models of shared stocks where you have more than a country sharing one stock, how to manage it sustainably, both in terms of economics and ecology. So that is how I started. And then I ended up coming to UBC in 95 as a visiting scholar. And that was the story, right? I came here, and by the time I finished, there was interest in staying here, and I wanted to stay. And then, yeah, became a professor at the Fisheries Center.
Now, why fisheries? Why did that intrigue you? Was being in Norway part of that, or were you surrounded by issues involving fisheries?
And Norway was definitely a reason, because fish is so important in Norway. So you could hardly meet one or two professors that don't have something to do with fisheries. So that clearly was part of the reason I got into fisheries. But intellectually, fisheries is quite interesting because it's very challenging, right? Right from the ecology through to the fact that you cannot own fish. Fish don't respect national borders and so on. And so it makes it really challenging and therefore very interesting as a research tool. And so that was attractive to me too.
Can you tell us about the Fisheries Economics Research Unit at UBC?
Yeah, this is one of a number of units at the Fisheries Center at UBC. We also have the quantitative modeling group. We have the Sea Around Us project. We have Project Seahorse. And in all, we have recently we have started a First Nations unit also. So we have quite a number. We have the Marine Mammal Unit. The Fisheries Economic Unit is my unit, and we are made up of graduate students, postdocs, research associates. And what we do is actually to link up with our ecologists at the center to actually bring economics into the whole research profile of the center. And what we try to do is to do research that will help society manage its natural resources, fisheries in particular, sustainably through time, like I usually say, for the benefit of all generations. So, yeah, that's the function we perform.
So can you give us a very brief definition of how economics and fisheries work?
Yeah. You know, the whole thing is fish is a lot about nature. We're talking about capture fisheries, marine fisheries, fish that we do not plant. I mean, this is a gift of nature. And so understanding the biology and the economics is very fundamental, because everything starts from there. Without the fish, there will be no fisheries. There will be no fish food, protein for us to eat. So it's very important to understand the ecology, okay? But once you understand the ecology, you have to bring the human element in there. You want to know what drives people to fish. Usually we fish for food, we fish for profits even, we fish. Governments want to employ people in fisheries because employment is important. So you have to bring that aspect, the human aspect, and bringing the two together in the model framework, for example, helps you to understand both the natural system and the human system, which is you need both to be able to really manage these things sustainably.
In a recent article, you discussed one element of this, and that's the jobs. And one of the things you said was that if you look at, you know, from a, you know, world perspective, fisheries has contributed to more than 260 million jobs worldwide. But there's, in fact, in there, an invisible workforce. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the thing about fisheries is you can split it into two broad categories. You have the commercial, industrial, large-scale fisheries, and you have the informal, a lot of small-scale, artisanal, subsistence fishing, where people catch the fish mostly to eat, actually, or feed their families, or to sell in local markets, small markets, in the developing world. In parts of the developed world, or also in Canada, you can think of First Nations fisheries. Now, what happens is when you look at global statistics, a lot of the stats you see is about the commercial large-scale ones, and we miss quite a bit from the informal subsistence, and that is what we call in the invisible part. And it turns out that that can actually be larger than the commercial. It's just that we don't count them statistically. And this has consequences, because then governments tend to focus more on the commercial, because that's what is in the books, even though the subsistence ones are more important to people, to their livelihoods, to their food security. So in that report, in that paper, we try to actually estimate the invisible part to bring it up into the literature, so people can really see the true picture and importance of fisheries around the world.
Were you surprised by the findings?
Yeah, absolutely. The size was the size was quite significant of the small scale compared to the large scale. So that was a surprise. I mean, we always knew that there's a lot that is not accounted for, but not that much. Yeah.
Tell us about the World Ocean Summit that you spoke at last month in Singapore.
Yeah, the World Ocean Summit was put together by The Economist, the magazine The Economist. So I think slowly fisheries are receiving a lot of attention, and people are realizing this is important. We all go to the supermarket or the restaurant, we order fish without actually knowing about our fish, where the fish comes from, whether they're sustainable. So slowly the information is getting through, and The Economist actually, of all magazines, found it necessary to bring together the world's leaders in fisheries, from academia to business to politics. We had a president and a prime minister at the meeting. We had Prince Charles giving us a talk through video conferencing. We have the head of NOAA, that's the American Oceans Administrator, Jane Lubchenco, giving us a talk. So that was a very big, powerful meeting of about 300 people, right from academics to top political leaders, to discuss the issue of sustainability of global fisheries. I found the meeting useful in a number of ways because it raised awareness, and now highly powerful people are taking notice, and hopefully this will help us put in place the kind of management systems we need to sustain our fisheries through time.
What did you present at? What was your presentation about?
That's interesting. I was on a panel. And we had 5 minutes each to talk, and then this was open to the panel. And I got a question. They asked me whether fisheries or marine fisheries have a role to play in the food security of the world. How much more fish can we get? How much fish can we get to feed the world's population? And the answer is, fortunately for me, we've done some research and published papers on this. If we do the right things, if we manage our fisheries well, it is possible for us to increase the quantity of fish we take out of the ocean today, which is roughly about 80 million tons of fish that we pull out of the oceans every year. And if you want to think of this in terms of cows, that is about 80 million cows we take out of the ocean. Can you imagine that? Estimates put the world's consumption of cows at about 50 million. So we are taking more cows than the world eats a year from the world's oceans. Mm-hmm. And if we manage distance well, we could get another 10 million tons, which would be 10 million cows. So mm-hmm. That was what I talked about, you know.
So tell us about some of these initiatives. And one of them that I spoke with one of your colleagues, Dr. Polly, about was about marine protected areas, or what they call MPAs. Mm. Do you feel that is one of the, you know, one of the tools that's really available to safeguard the world's fisheries?
Yeah, marine protected areas is one of the tools we have to manage our oceans. And actually, we use protected areas a lot on land. Estimates put the world's land area that is protected at about 15%. At the moment, we protect the ocean less than 1%, according to estimate, or just over 1%. Mm. And this is part of the tools we have, and I think it's a useful tool. Even from just an economic point of view, this could be seen as buying insurance from our mistakes. So if we protect a significant part of the ocean, if we make mistakes in the places we fish, we will have the protected area to help us recover, for example, replenish. Mm-hmm. So yes, marine protected areas are good management tools. It should be part of our toolkit to help manage our fishery resources.
Can you tell us briefly how they work and where some might exist today?
Yeah, essentially, a marine protected area is a part of the ocean that is carved out and protected, sometimes fully protected, say, from fishing. And then we call them marine reserves. So this area, you cannot fish. That's it. And that's it. But then you have different levels of protection. Sometimes you say, okay, you can fish, but you cannot use bottom trawlers, for example, because they impact on the bottom and affect the habitat. So we don't do. So you can have a gradation of protection of marine protected areas of part of the ocean. And that is what I meant by insurance, because then you have that protected. And then when you can have the larvae or eggs of fish floating into the non-protected area, replenishing it. You can have mature fish moving out, migrating into to help the fishery where we fish. So yeah, that's how they work.
And where do some exist currently?
Yeah, in Canada there are a few, there are many, but they are really very small bits of it. And then in the U.S. there are protected areas. In fact, around Hawaii, one of the things George Bush did, which made some conservationists happy, was declaring a big chunk of the ocean around Hawaii as a protected area. So you have that example too. Now in the developing world, you have examples of this also, where either traditionally people have various reasons for not fishing in different areas of the ocean. Yeah.
Now, you recently also mapped the locations of six major conservation danger zones where short-term thinking and the temptation to profit from overfishing are overwhelming some of the more urgent conservation needs. Can you tell us about these zones?
Yeah, this work is another example of how teaming up ecologists and economists can help us get insights on how to manage fisheries. The whole idea here is, when you talk to ecologists, they will be able to tell you fish, different fish types and species that are vulnerable to fishing and those that are not. Usually this is based on life history of the fish. If a fish is very productive, it has a short lifespan and is very productive, usually you can fish it more because they will reproduce very quickly. So ecologists will tell you they are less vulnerable to fishing. Then you have species that are slow growing, very long lived, live in the deep sea, very dark, no light. So they will be considered as vulnerable. So that's the ecological side. Now, when you go to an economist, you say, okay, we understand if you look at the life history. But another thing is important here. Those fishing the fish, how do they obey economic rules? What pressures do they face? Are they loaded with debt and therefore they want to earn money to pay off their mortgages on their boats? Are they poor? They need the food to eat now. So we also have a way to measure vulnerability. So in this study, we brought those two, the ecology and the economics, together and identified areas of the world ocean where the fishes, based on their economics, and the fish, based on their life history, they are either very vulnerable or they are not. And so we say for some areas, ecology and economics can coexist, but in other areas they cannot, because the fish will get depleted because of the economic drivers. So that was what this study did. And we map it around the world, and you can see where there are issues and where there are not. And one of our goals in doing that, there are many goals, but one of them is to help management authorities actually identify vulnerable areas, taking the two, ecology and economics, together, and therefore helping them to allocate their scarce resources, management resources, so we can get more management results from the budget we have, rather than spreading all the money all over.
In another recent article, you have proposed a new approach to managing global fisheries that could finally put an end to international disputes over fishery subsidies. Can you first maybe define what fishery subsidies are, and then also how you basically, in this article, you're proposing the idea that fisheries should be managed domestically, you know, as well as internationally, but perhaps separately rather than together?
Yeah, you know, subsidies has taken a lot of my time in the past few years. And fisheries subsidies essentially are payments, financial payments or advantages given to the fishing sector by governments around the world. And many of the listeners will be surprised to know that a lot of this is going on. Our recent estimate of the total amount of subsidies paid by governments around the world to the fishing sector is $27 billion a year, subsidies. And this is against an $80 billion industry. So you're talking about up to 30%, 35% of the gross revenues of the sector is subsidies from governments. Now, the reason fisheries scientists and scholars don't like subsidies is that they distort the market and make it more profitable individually for the private fisher, more profitable to go fish than not. So if your fish stocks are already in trouble, because they are being overfished, and you give subsidies, it just goes to make the situation worse. So we are paying people to undermine the resource base, which is what you don't want to do normally. So that is why subsidies is such a big issue. And the world has been struggling to deal with this. In 2001, the WTO was given the mandate by the world community to actually discipline these subsidies, take them down, the subsidies that are harmful or bad, as we call them, that lead to overcapacity. Since 2001 to date, World Trade Organization has not been able to do anything because the world's nations cannot agree. They have different interests, and so it's tough. That is what led me to write the paper you mentioned, the short paper I did, which appeared in Nature. And what I said in there is, how do we get the world community to make progress in terms of disciplining the harmful subsidies? And I thought, as an economist, I thought the reason we are not getting movement is nations have different interests, and these interests are impeding on finding a solution. So how about we do this? We say, okay, we take the world's fisheries, we split them into international fisheries, that is fisheries that are in the high seas, that is part of the ocean that are not allocated to coastal nations of the world. And then we have the domestic, those within the coastal waters of coastal nations of the world, that what is called exclusive economic zones of nations, which is 200 nautical miles away from your coast. So those will be domestic. If we can identify the fisheries that operate within the domestic countries, and then we say, okay, these have to be managed by the nations. And if they don't manage the fish well, they face the consequences, right? So in a way, that will push the incentives closer to the countries. And hopefully that could help in getting them to move on the domestic ones. But the international ones are more complicated because one can go there and overfish, get the benefit, and the rest of the world will suffer the pain. So we need a global solution for that. So that was what I was trying to do in that paper, trying to find a way to push us to move forward a bit on this issue.
Are you optimistic about the future of the world's fisheries?
Yeah, you know, overall I am, because I know the humanity always faces problems. This is part of our life, and we're always trying to find solutions. I'm optimistic because the more we push, the more the information goes to the public, the more the public knows and realizes that the fish we are eating today may not be there. Hopefully, slowly, that will get to our governments. And in democracies, it's almost easy to do that. But actually, these days, even in non-democracies, because of social media, we've seen what is happening around the world. Even if you are a dictator, increasingly, it's becoming clear that you cannot ignore your population for too long. So based on these and other things happening, I'm optimistic.
And do you have any advice for the average consumer of, you know, seafood or fish?
Yeah, I mean, I was asked this question before, and how did I formulate it? Number one, as a consumer, I think it would be great as much as possible for consumers to take responsibility and do the best they can. Make sure your fish is coming from sustainable sources. I know it's not easy, but there are mechanisms being developed, PFC choices, that help you. They are far from perfect, but at least it's a little contribution towards that. One of the big things you can do as a consumer or as a person is to also think about sustainability of the oceans when you do something like voting, because that's where the power lies, right? You want your representative to talk for the ocean, to work for the ocean, for ourselves, actually, because ultimately we benefit from a well-managed ocean. So the voting, the public side, and as an individual in your own actions, you do the best you can to help the world to be sustainable.
I remember in the 90s, I went to Newfoundland, and I was, you know, a young person at that time, and it was actually shortly after the collapse of the cod fishery, which was incredibly devastating, and I still think of that. But you do cite Newfoundland as an example in several of your articles, and you know, as a warning of, I suppose, of how Canadians need to remember what can happen to our fisheries.
Oh, yeah. I mean, The Newfoundland collapse, the cod collapse of Newfoundland, is one of the classic examples of what collapse of an important fish stock can mean in terms of people, in terms of jobs, in terms of livelihood. When the moratorium was called in 1992, it was a huge thing. I mean, about 40,000 people or household members were impacted. And Canada had to quickly put together billions of dollars to try to ease the pain and so on. So the collapse came and we found the resources to try to help. But by then, it was too late. We've lost the fish and people are in suffering. We could have saved the situation by managing and listening to sciences and doing the right thing. We could have saved much more, both in terms of human pain and in terms of hard cash. But we didn't do that until the collapse. So this is an example, not only me, but other scientists use as a way to remind the population of the possible consequences and therefore the need to be more proactive than reactive, which is the way our governments operate these days. They wait until the damage is done and everybody's rushing in. We could do better, please, I think. Yeah.
And finally, what is your goal? You are the director of the Fishery Center at UBC. What is your ultimate goal that you hope to achieve, let's say, you know, before you retire?
That's a big one. If in any way, my contributions together with my colleagues and my students, if we can contribute to helping the world move the direction, the big declines we have seen in fish stocks and fisheries around the world, if we can turn that direction a bit, I would be happy as a retired old man.
Thank you, Rashid. It's been so wonderful to have you. And I hope to have you on the show again to follow up on all this incredible research that you and your team are doing.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
I've just been speaking with Dr. Rashid Sumaila. He is the professor and director of the Fisheries Center and the Fisheries Economics Research Unit at UBC. For more information about his research, please visit feru.org. You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC's CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR. On CITR.ca. Prof Talk airs every Tuesday at 3 p.m. and features live interviews with professors from a variety of disciplines. Next week, I will speak with Dr. Andrew Wallace Hadrill, who is the Master of Sydney Sussex College and Professor of Roman Studies at Cambridge University. He'll be visiting UBC as Cecil H. and Ida Green, a visiting professor. If you would like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, please visit proftalk.ubc.ca or email us at prof.talk@ubc.ca. I'm your host, Farha Khan. Thank you for listening today.
Lenny of Mass Grave. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.